It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
A nighttime curfew to fight Ebola in Liberia's capital is imposed. The Ebola death toll in West Africa climbs to nearly 1,230. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf announced a nighttime curfew in the West Point neighborhood of the capital of Monrovia beginning today after an isolation facility treating Ebola patients was attacked and looted. The government announced it has accounted for all 17 patients who fled that attack. Ebola has killed more than 460 in Liberia, but the government says three patients are improving after having been given the experimental drug ZMapp. Tuesday, the World Health Organization said another 113 cases of the disease have been confirmed over 2 days, August 14 to 16, with another 84 fatalities. The death toll now stands at 1,229. Fidela Chaib, a WHO spokesperson, said four countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria, remain at the center of the battle to contain Ebola.
The response of WHO and other partners to the Ebola is continuing in the four countries to reduce the likelihood that those who are affected would carry the disease outside their community. The governments have set up quarantine zones in areas of high transmission, including severely affected cities such as Kikidu in Guinea, Kinima and Kailahum in Sierra Leone, and Foya in Liberia.
The UN Health Agency announced Tuesday the number of confirmed and likely infections has risen to 2,240. The WHO says there's cautious optimism the spread of the virus in Nigeria can be stopped. The country has had four confirmed fatalities, only 12 cases. But Tuesday, the Nigerian Health Ministry confirmed a doctor who treated the Liberian-American who visited Lagos and died of Ebola last month has herself died. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization describes the situation in Guinea, where the virus was first detected in February, as currently less alarming than it is in Sierra Leone and Liberia. WHO is working with the World Food Program to ensure food deliveries to some 1 million people currently living in quarantine zones in three of those affected countries. The British physician leading the UN effort against Ebola, David Nabarro, is heading to West Africa to see how the world body can support efforts to fight Ebola.
It's affecting the social setting. It's affecting economies. It's affecting governance. It's got humanitarian consequences. It's got political repercussions. It may have security impacts. A really comprehensive support operation is necessary that involves all the different assets, tools, capacities in our United Nations system.
Nabarro heads to the four affected countries after a stop in Washington today. An analyst suggests the militant Islamist group Boko Haram's bloody five-year insurgency in northern Nigeria may be emulating past conflicts in Africa by gaining the loyalty of their victims, Heather Murdoch reports.
Kidnapped victims are strengthening Boko Haram by growing their army, says Ya Sampierre, the CEO of the Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon. Where once the group was just trying to survive, he says it is now trying to take over territories.
Boko Haram is now planning strategically long-term. It's not about replenishing forces, it's about acquiring more personnel.
Boko Haram has killed thousands of people this year alone in a growing five-year-old insurgency. Constantly morphing, the group says it wants to enforce a harsh version of Islamic law and is increasingly well-armed and well-funded. Sampierre says Boko Haram has begun using tactics pioneered by Joseph Kony in Uganda and Charles Taylor in Sierra Leone to gain loyalty from victims. He says Boko Haram also kidnaps girls and women, including the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted 4 months ago to use as household help, sex slaves, and most recently, bombers. If villagers are terrified into pledging loyalty to Boko Haram, the group can essentially control the area without hanging flags or building walls. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The UN envoy to Central African Republic says 7,600 soldiers will take over peacekeeping responsibilities on September 15th. Babacar Gaye says that's about 65% of the nearly 12,000-strong force authorized in April by the Security Council. CAR has been in turmoil since an alliance of Muslim rebels known as the Salika overthrew longtime President Francois Bozizé last year. Thousands have been killed in ensuing sectarian violence. A transitional government backed by 2,000 French troops and African peacekeepers have tried to stabilize the situation. I'm Victor
Beatty. That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria says it is making progress in containing the Ebola outbreak.
We need to secure our airports, we need to secure our land borders, we need to secure our seaports. Our second strategy, having had the index case, was to now immediately quarantine, confirm the diagnosis, and isolate them and treat.
Onyebuchi Chukwu is Nigeria's health minister. Liberia says it has accounted for all 37 Ebola patients who fled an isolation center. South Sudan takes protective measures against Ebola. Meanwhile, South Sudan's government delegation is accused of boycotting sessions of ongoing peace talks in Addis Ababa.
It is unfortunate that the government have decided not to participate as of... they have withdrawn, actually, from Friday. They did not attend Saturday sessions, and they did not also attend the plenary of today and also the semantic committees.
Tibandan Guy is chief rebel negotiator. A new study says more than 100,000 African elephants were killed in the past 3 years. And we have a report on the investigation in the police killing of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's health minister says the government has made progress in containing the Ebola disease by implementing a multidimensional and multisectorial approach to combat the disease after some infected patients were successfully treated and discharged. There have been 12 confirmed Ebola cases in Nigeria with at least 4 deaths. Onyebuchi Chukwu says the government will not relent in its effort to eradicate the Ebola disease. Chukwu tells reporter Peter Clarty that the government is stepping up efforts to secure the country's borders by screening travelers at the point of entry.
The effort has been multi-sectoral, multi-dimensional. We are looking at all the possible thematic areas. One is how do we secure our borders? As you know, the index case we had, a Liberian American just flew overhead and landed on our shores. So that was the issue. So we need to secure our airports, we need to secure our land borders, we need to secure our seaports. Our second strategy is having had the index case and having had primary contacts, many of them actually from the hospital that took care of the index case, was to now immediately quarantine, confirm the diagnosis and isolate them and treat, and then begin to pursue other primary contacts. So we've done that, but right now in Lagos, we are following up on 191 secondary contacts, and but none of them is symptomatic.
With this multifaceted approach to it, how sure is your administration implementing policies to ensure it is contained and to give public confidence? Because I hear people are really concerned about these cases.
Well, to start with, out of the 12 confirmed cases, the 12 confirmed cases include the index case. So one non-Nigerian and 11 Nigerians have been diagnosed. But out of the 12, unfortunately, we have lost 4. So we have 4 deaths, including the index case. Now, of the 8 that are surviving, we have actually successfully managed 5 of them. They've been discharged home. So I don't know. That should give everyone confidence that we're doing the right thing. So 5, as I speak to you, 5 have been discharged. We have only 3 still on admission. And we have every hope they will recover.
Mr. Health Minister, with these successes that you've just enumerated, will there be a possibility of your country lending this expertise to other West Africans having this problem? You're talking about Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone.
Certainly, we will. Recall that when the WHO first called a meeting on Ebola virus disease, Nigeria didn't even have a single case. And at that meeting, Nigeria pledged to support technically, because we hadn't consulted with our president, so we said we'll offer technical assistance. And Nigeria immediately pledged the sum of $3.5 million. And we are the first also to have redeemed our pledge. So at that time, Nigeria didn't have any case. But now, we're expecting in a few weeks' time that ministers of health of ECOWAS states will meet again in Accra. And we're going to reemphasize that we're willing to be of help to the other ECOWAS countries.
Onyebuchi Chukwu is Nigeria's health minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Liberia's Information Minister Louise Brown says the government has put in place necessary measures to mitigate the economic impact of Ebola on the country. This comes as more and more Liberians are complaining about rising prices of basic commodities. Brown says President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has told businesses that while her government strongly believes in free market system, any unnecessary increases in prices will be considered a crime against the people. Meanwhile, Minister Brown says the government was able to account for all 37 suspected Ebola patients who fled an isolated center in Monrovia after it was attacked and looted by armed men on Sunday. He tells me the incident was a result of a misunderstanding between the community and the government.
No one in that center had been confirmed as an Ebola patient. People were moving around because this was really a holding center. Yes, people were there as probable and suspect cases, but none of the cases had been confirmed as Ebola cases. These were individuals who had been exposed and were at risk of exposure and contamination by this virus. But then when young people heard that there were others from outside West Point who were in the center itself, then they took it to the center and sort of forced everyone out. But that situation has now been remedied. And one of the things we've learned is that we intend to increase security presence at these centers.
Mr. Minister, your government says that at least three Ebola-infected healthcare workers who received the drug ZMAP are making progress. Yet at the same time, the World Health Organization is saying that there were new cases reported. Many of those new cases were in Liberia. Does your government feel the state of emergency is not helping to reduce the number of infected people?
No, not the least. There are areas where we are showing signs of encouragement, areas which were initially identified as epic centers of the disease. These areas are now showing signs of improvement. The numbers are down. In and around Monrovia continues to be a difficult area, posing many, many challenges. This weekend situation in West Point is a case in point. But at the same time, we're continuing to take the measures, including proper public awareness and education. We know we will not simply police our way out of this. To be able to solve this problem, you need people to be aware of the danger and to take the necessary preventive measures.
I've received a number of calls and emails from Liberians who have complained about something called the economic of Ebola. They refer to hunger, high prices for basic commodities. Is your government, first of all, aware of this so-called economic of Ebola? And what are you doing to make sure that people don't abuse the system?
There's always going to be those types of individuals, but the president met with the business community. She warned against such practices. They reassure her that they will make sure that, especially the manufacturers, will make sure that whatever, especially the things that Liberians will need to fight this disease are not increased on them, and that such increases will be considered a crime against the people of Liberia at a time of the truth of the matter is we must act to protect our people, especially under these difficult circumstances, from undue hardship and burden.
Liberia's Information Minister Louise Brown was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Health officials in Juba say they are stepping up their efforts to ensure the deadly Ebola virus does not spread to South Sudan. People are being checked when they enter the country to make sure they do not have fever, one of the early symptoms of Ebola. Mugumi Davis Rakringi of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Armed with thermometers and notepads, a team of health officials has set up shops in two tents that have been pitched just meters away from where planes land at Juba's busy airport. Whenever a traveler disembarks,
when someone comes, we give him this form to fill it. His name, his nationality, airport of dispatcher.
They use a non-contact infrared thermometer to see if the arriving passenger have a fever.
Now, your temperature is 36.3. It means you are free from Ebola disease.
That is Frederick Ladu, a public health official from the Central Equatorial Ministry of Health. He is one of the 20 South Sudanese officials trained by the World Health Organization, or WHO, to screen for Ebola at the airport. The officials gather information including which countries the incoming passenger have visited in the last 21 days. That information is needed because the Ebola outbreak has impacted Western African countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and WHO says a small number of people in Nigeria. The authorities in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea say they are already checking departing passengers for signs of fever or illness. The key tool that health officials at Juba International Airport are using to keep Ebola out of South Sudan is the thermometer, Ladu says.
We register because to know whether this patient is affected or not. If the temperature is 38 centigrade degree, means that this man, we have to detain him for a while.
WHO medical officer Dr. Abdunazir Abbakar says the likelihood of the Ebola virus being transmitted on an aeroplane is very low. But he also notes that screening someone for fever at the airport is not a 100% sure way of detecting Ebola.
A patient might contract an Ebola yesterday and then they fly today to Juba, and when they come to the airport, they may not show any symptoms. But after 3 weeks, they may, you know, show symptoms. That's some of the weaknesses for the screening at the airport. But in the meantime also, it's a good tool that can help you to identify if there's any patient who may have a high fever, you know, while they're entering into the countries.
International travel can help to spread Ebola, and countries need to be prepared, he says. South Sudan has set up an Ebola task force led by Vice President James Wani Iga to try to keep the country Ebola-free. For VOA News, I am Gumedes Ruakarinj in Juba.
It's Wednesday morning, August 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM, in opposition, is accusing South Sudan's government delegation to the peace talks in Addis Ababa of failing to attend sessions for the last 4 days, including yesterday's. Eskindo Feru of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has the details from Addis Ababa.
The opposition chief negotiator, Taban Dengai, says the government has been absent from the talks in Addis for some time now.
It is unfortunate that the government have decided not to participate as of... they have withdrawn, actually, from Friday. They did not attend Saturday sessions, and they did not also attend the plenary of today and also the semantic committees.
South Sudan's information minister, Michael Makwilwes, who is also the government spokesman at the talks, declined to comment on the issue. In a hotel hallway, the minister told VOA he does not want to negotiate through the media. Guy says he believes the government delegation is merely avoiding talks on the formation of a transitional government, which would include officials from the opposition.
Their main problem is that they don't want to discuss issues. Actually, they don't want to share power. This is the main problem. They were not happy with the position of political parties on power sharing. They were not happy on the proposal of the leaders of the SPLM, former detainees, on proposal of power sharing. They are not happy of our position on power sharing.
Taman Dengai says they will continue with other stakeholders at the talks with or without the participation of the government. IGAD mediators were not available for comment. The United States, the United Nations, and other countries have warned both sides that if they do not take the talks seriously, more sanctions could follow. Sanctions were imposed on the top army commanders of both sides. For VOA News, I am Skender Freo in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Poachers have killed more than 100,000 African elephants in the past 3 years, according to a new study released this week by researchers working in Kenya, the United States, and the United Kingdom. George Wittemayo, who led the study, tells Reiki Shryak that this report is the first to provide scientifically reliable numbers on how many elephants are killed every year in Africa for their ivory.
Before this, we haven't had definitive numbers on which to discuss or act. It also provides a really interesting case study in the Samburu system, which shows the level of illegal killing in that population was strongly related to the local black market ivory price that the poachers are getting in the Samburu system, and that's strongly correlated with the volume of ivory that's flowing through Kenya as a nation.
How many elephants per year has your study concluded are being killed due to illegal poaching?
It averages a little over 30,000 a year. And over the period 2010 to 2012, unfortunately, it looks like we lost over 100,000 elephants on the continent.
And is this multiple species of elephants?
This is focused on African elephants. There's some debate if the forest versus savanna are different species. And we just lumped them all together and treated them as one for this study. So it's just elephants on the continent of Africa.
Did your study find that the killing for ivory was also linked to the amount of unrest in a certain region, for example, Central African Republic?
Well, we didn't actually focus on that, but I guess anecdotally, it certainly can. And some of the worst hit countries are the least stable. So you could take that to mean it does. But it's more complicated than that, actually. And still waiting to find out, but it looks like in Central African Republic, through all this impact, that they really experienced massive declines in their elephants, you know, a decade before this, or two decades before, really in the 70s and 80s. And so the unrest right now has caused problems for the elephants there. But actually, the elephants in that country, if the information we're getting on the ground, it looks like the elephants haven't been decimated during the most recent civil war. And part of that is because they can escape to other regions of Africa where it's more safe. They can go into the Republic of Congo or Cameroon. And so they may be doing that.
What's the best kind of average price you can give me for an ounce of ivory?
We usually talk about it by the kilo, and that's a really tough question. So in the end market in China, the most coveted pieces can be in the thousands of dollars per kilo. For the poacher on the ground in Samburu, which is where the only numbers we actually have, in 2011 when we had the worst killing, it got up to about $150 a kilo to the poacher.
That was Josh Wittemeyer, an assistant professor in the Colorado State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Fort Collins, Colorado. Police in the central U.S. city of St. Louis, Missouri, have shot dead a man armed with a knife near the site of violent protest against the police shooting death of an unarmed black teenager on August 9th. Police say the suspect in Tuesday's shooting allegedly stole merchandise from a food store. The latest shooting comes as U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder plans to arrive in Ferguson today, Wednesday, to meet with federal officials who are investigating the August 9th shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Meanwhile, a grand jury will hear evidence in the fatal police shooting of Brown. VOA's Chris Simpkins has more on the investigation into the August 9th shooting.
Prosecutors are examining evidence in the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Since the shooting, residents in the predominantly African American community have demanded answers about what happened. Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, says her son was murdered and wants a thorough investigation.
Being fair, arresting this man and making him accountable for his actions.
There are conflicting accounts about the circumstances that led to Michael Brown's death. Police released surveillance video allegedly showing the teenager stealing cigars at a convenience store shortly before the incident. But investigators say the robbery was not the reason why Officer Wilson pulled up to Brown in his patrol car when he saw him on the street. They say at some point the officer was pushed into his squad car, then physically assaulted during a struggle. At least one shot was fired inside the car. St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar.
It is our understanding at this point in the investigation that within the police car there was a struggle over the officer's weapon.
Police say Wilson had bruises on his face, but witnesses paint a different picture.
The kid was kind of like trying to push off away from the cop, and the cop was trying to pull him in.
It is unclear what happened next, but other witnesses say Brown was running away from the officer after being shot.
He was running, and then he turned around and put his arms up. He just stopped, put his hands up after he had gotten shot repeatedly.
We've got one that entered the top.
Attorneys for the Brown family released the results of an independent autopsy that suggests the unarmed teenager was shot multiple times from the front, including two shots to the head. The autopsy found no signs of a struggle between Brown and the officer. Brown family attorney Benjamin Crump.
It verifies that the witness accounts were true, that he was shot multiple times.
Two other autopsies on Brown's body have been conducted by local and federal investigators. Meanwhile, Officer Wilson's friends say he reportedly told them he fired the last shots as Brown was charging towards him, but investigators have not confirmed this. Legal analysts say the evidence prosecutors present to the grand jury will be key in determining if Officer Wilson is charged with the crime in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
Minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the Olympic Youth Games in Nanjing, China. Tunisia edged Romania 12-10 in boys' 3-on-3 basketball, while in the girls' contest, Egypt lost to the Czech Republic 19-10 and the United States of America 21-6 on Tuesday. Today, Wednesday, Tunisia played New Zealand and Guatemala, while Egypt faced Romania in the girls' contest. In boys' beach volleyball, Ghana's Kwabena Phillips and Nicolas Tete edged the Virgin Islands' Carlos Rosa and Ajia Sweeney by 2-1. South Africa beat Australia 8-2, while Uruguay beat Zambia 7-1 in girls' five-a-side hockey. In the boys' contest, South Africa pipped Australia 6-5, while Mexico beat Zambia 6-2. In seven-a-side rugby, Kenya beat Fiji 17-12 in the boys' contest before losing 19-12 to Argentina in the semifinals on Tuesday. Fiji and Kenya clash again today, Wednesday, this time in the bronze medal playoff. In the girls' contest, Tunisia lost 26-0 to the United States of America and 25-5 to Spain. Turning to football, Rwanda's police and Burundi's Atletico drew 0-0 before the police edged Atletico 9-8 in a sudden death penalty shootout in the quarterfinals at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's Sekafa Kagame Club Championships in Kigali, Rwanda on Tuesday. Then, ARC rivals Rayon Sports and Rwanda's military side APR drew 2-2. The soldiers prevailed 4-3 in the ensuing penalty spot kicks. Today, Wednesday, Sudan's El Merrek play Tanzania mainland's Azam before the Uganda's Kampala City Council authorities engage South Sudan's Atlabara in the remaining quarterfinals in Kigali. Staying with football, the World Health Organization, WHO, does not recommend a ban on the travel to and from areas affected by the deadly Ebola virus. Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and parts of Nigeria have recently experienced fatalities from the deadly disease. In a circular to the Confederation of African Football, the WHO's Isabel Nuttall clarifies that the Ebola virus is not airborne. Instead, it is transmitted by direct contact with body fluids from an infected person. She emphasizes that an Ebola patient is in such a physical condition that they cannot travel. On a more cheerful note, the Nigerian Falconets play North Korea in the semifinals at the FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup in Moncton, Canada today, Wednesday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, August 20th.
Good morning. I'm Comrade Samuel Yembra of the Campaign for African Progress, commenting from Warrington, Delta State, Nigeria. I call on African youth to cultivate an enduring sense of nationhood and dedicate their lives to the public good of their country. For no nation becomes great until the select few of its citizens first dedicate their lives to the good of that country. And great nations are built on patriotism and nationalism. Be a patriot, be a nationalist, and think outside the box.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. And that's it for this Wednesday, August 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Button in Washington, saying, have a nice day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.